arts that I do understand are work with my student Shauna Kravick and Brian. I've learned from Senthil that the name for the subject of this talk is a concept called emergibility, which is the following thing. So everybody knows that a crucial step in building an effective field theory is to identify the degrees of freedom that are that exist in the energy regime of interest, and how they realize the symmetries of the system. But this concept of emergibility refers to an additional constraint on an effective field theory, which is really a high energy requirement, which is that if you know what the microphysical Hilbert space is, of which this effective field theory is supposed to be an effective description, then an additional constraint on the effective field theory is that these degrees of freedom with this realization of the symmetry can actually live in that Hilbert space as a subset of that Hilbert space. Okay, this may sound kind of innocuous, but we'll see some examples where apparent reasonable effective field theories fail this criterion. So notice it depends on what the UV degrees of freedom are, not on what their Hamiltonian is at all. But so, you know, if I tell you that my Hilbert space is some tensor product over some lattice or some sites of some local Hilbert spaces, each of which, you know, it's really a tensor product, then that constrains what effective field theories can emerge from it. So that hence the name. And some checks of this requirement of an effective field theory that are familiar in high energy physics, a way to formulate the statement is that all RG invariants should be the same in both the low energy Hilbert space and the high energy one. And a familiar high energy realization of this criterion is a Tufte anomaly matching. So namely, this criterion is available when both the UV description and the low energy description are continuum descriptions, and when the symmetries in question are continuous symmetries. And then we can imagine asking what would happen if we gauged those symmetries and compute the usual triangle anomalies. And a Tufte art convinced us that these quantities, the coefficients of those anomalies, are invariant under the RG. And so this is a condition that a given candidate for an effective field theory is a possible one. Okay, a different kind of example of this criterion is the following, which is in the situation I was describing a moment ago. If our Hilbert space is the tensor product of just qubits or something like this, just bosonic Hilbert spaces where there are no fermions, no fermionic operators, then it's not possible for your low energy field theory to involve fermions, which are gauge invariant, local fermionic operators, which are really gauge invariant. That just can't happen. So that's a different kind of an example of such a constraint, which I don't know how to describe in this language of a Tufte anomaly matching.
Can you prove this? This is supposed to be obvious.
It's supposed to be obvious. Yes. Yes. Okay. So now you might say that I've come to the wrong meeting, because there's some sense in which this is actually a high energy problem for low energy physicists, right? Where, you know, if you're say doing condensed matter physics, where you actually know what the microscopic degrees of freedom are, they're like electrons hopping in some lattice, and there's no question about, you know, adding new beyond the standard model physics or this kind of thing that might affect your answer, then certainly this is an important constraint on any effective description you might try to give of some state of matter. But I guess I'll defend my decision to talk about this by mentioning that actually many questions of exactly this nature have been raised in various talks already this week. So for example, the question of whether a people's IP superfluid could be coupled to gravity without introducing a spin structure was raised in Sergey's talk, and the question of whether a CFT always has a stress tensor was an answer was stated by Zohar, these are exactly the kinds of questions I'm talking about. Okay, so a high energy physics point of view, a reason to care about this kind of question is the following, which is you could think of what I'm describing as identifying obstructions to symmetry preserving regulators of a given quantum field theory with some given symmetries. Which, you know, is the kind of thing you might want to do if you want to put the standard model on a lattice, for example. right, which has is a given quantum field theory with some given symmetries, which you might want to be able to teach a computer to solve. We're going to identify such obstructions by thinking about certain weird states of matter, which you might not ever want to think about otherwise, which live in one extra dimension and which have an energy gap. So by which I mean that the energy of the first excited state is strictly above the ground state energy, even in the thermodynamic limit. The particular class of states of matter that we're going to consider are called symmetry-protected topological states, SPT states, whose study, I guess, has been pioneered by Zhagong Wen and his group, and is and a review of what Senthil refers to as the physics-based approach to the subject just appeared. I want to try to convince you that these things are machines for producing obstructions of the form that I'm describing. Another motivation for thinking about them is that studying them is also a very useful step towards studying more difficult, interesting topological states of matter. So I should mention that this class of states of matter are much simpler than many of the crazy ones that you might have heard about. In a sense, I'll review in just a moment. Okay, so here's my goal. I'm going to explain what I mean by SPT states. I'm going to mention a few ideas which are due to other people that use this point of view to give insight about exactly this problem I just mentioned about putting the standard model on a lattice. And then I'm going to talk about some novel constraints on 3+1 dimensional field theories, not the standard model, actually very simple field theories, which arise from this point of view. And in particular, we'll identify some constraints on manifest electromagnetic duality symmetry in 3+1 dimensional gauge theory. If time allows, I'll say some things about a machine that we've been building to make very explicit constructions of these states, which I guess you could refer to what we're trying to do here as SPT states for dummies, because the people who work on the subject are too smart generally, and we need to this is an attempt to understand these states. Okay, so backing up quite a bit. Let me tell you, I've been saying this word state, let me tell you what I mean. So an important question is, what are the possible gapped phases of matter? A picture of the space of states of matter is the space of Hamiltonians, I mean, on some given Hilbert space is depicted is here. And I'm going to declare that two gapped states are equivalent, according to this equivalence relation, if starting from one of them, you can deform the Hamiltonian to the other one, without ever closing the energy gap. Okay, so in this picture, this red thing is the wall in the space of Hamiltonians, where the system becomes gapless. And I declare that this state is the same as this state. They're in the same state of matter, and this one is different. Definition has the drawback that you might need to, find, if you want to know whether this state and this state are different, according to this definition, you have to explore every possible path to get from one to the other and check if the gap closes. That's a hard thing to do. And so it's nice to have intrinsic criteria of ways to guarantee that no matter which way you go, you can never get from one to the other. And an important distinguishing feature is the question of how the symmetries are realized. And one distinction which has been very strongly emphasized in this meeting is the question of which symmetries of the Hamiltonian does the ground state of the system break. I'm going to declare this to be, you guys have taken care of this, it's well understood, and I'm not going to say anything else about that. Okay, so I'm going to assume all the symmetries I'm going to talk about are going to be linearly realized on my ground state. Let's ask a more refined question, which is, how do we distinguish states of matter that don't break any of the symmetries? A fancy answer to this question, and a fancy, very important answer to this question, is that the symmetries can be fractionalized, meaning that the way the symmetry is represented on the low energy excitations be very different from the way it's represented on the high energy excitations, in the sense that, for example, there could be particles with fractional charge or fractional spin. The general name for this is topological order. The way to describe it is in terms of deconfined gauge theories and long-range entanglement in the ground state. This is very interesting, and this is the class of states of matter, the difficult states of matter that I was referring to earlier, and I'm going to hereby declare them to be too difficult. Okay, so this is a long-term goal, And so let's save that for later and ask a simpler question, which is, what are possible gap phases that don't break symmetries and don't have any topological order? Okay, so that's the question. How might you distinguish two states of matter if they don't have either of these things? An interesting answer to this question is to consider what happens if you put the system on a space with boundaries. So a statement, I've put lots of qualifiers, but the statement is that a gap state of matter in D plus one dimension, this is spatial dimensions, which is not long range entangled, so that's what I mean by short range entanglement, can be characterized by properties of its edge states, by what happens when you make an interface between that state of matter and the vacuum or with a possibly different state. So the rough idea for why you might think that this is true is, if these states of matter are really different, then you know that when varying the Hamiltonian, so there's some parameter in the Hamiltonian, which I've called G here, which you have to vary to get from this Hamiltonian to this Hamiltonian. I guess I should have called them A and B. And you know, because there are different states of matter, that the gap has to close. And so you might imagine that if you vary that parameter in the Hamiltonian in space, so this is a plot of that parameter in the Hamiltonian as a function of this coordinate of space, that something interesting must have to happen when you reach the point where the gap would close if that were the Hamiltonian everywhere. This is true under this assumption of short-range entanglement because, you know, it's using the fact that varying the Hamiltonian here doesn't affect the state far away, right? That's the role of the short-range entanglement. And it's basically true. Okay, so a refinement of this idea is to consider, now I'm going to define what I mean by an SPT state. It's a state that's, an SPT state comes with a group. It's the group, there's a group which is doing the protecting. And it's a state which has short-range entanglement and which is not adiabatically connected in the sense I was just describing to a product state, to a state which is just a mean field state by local Hamiltonians which preserve the given symmetry. Okay, so this is saying that you can't get from this state to the other one without closing the gap if you restrict yourself to paths which preserve in the space of Hamiltonians which preserve the symmetry. It may be that if you allow yourself to break the symmetry, that you can go around the wall where the gap closes and connect these two states. Okay, so famous examples of this are free fermion topological insulators, which you can read about in the newspaper, which one way that they can be terminated with the vacuum is that they can have an odd number of direct cones, which on the surface. So that's a weird thing, which it's hard to do in a lattice model, as I'll remind you later. A reason to care about this, the reason to care about this, just the space of Hamiltonians, which preserves some symmetry, is you could imagine that if you're interested in making a gauge theory by gauging this symmetry or some subgroup of it, then in this way you can get an interesting state by gauging it. You can make a deconfined phase of that gauge theory, which will be at a state with topological order. And so by classifying or thinking about interesting ways in which the symmetry can be realized along the lines I was just describing, you can thereby think about what would happen if you did gauge the symmetry. Okay, so a few words about how many of these things there are. So this case with free fermions has been very well classified in terms of K-theory. Interactions between the particles, so not just free fermions, not just free bosons, can affect the answer for how many different such states there are in both ways. In particular, it can be that there are states which are in the same phase, but only by paths that involve using interacting systems. Right? So if you restrict yourself just to free theories, there are different states of matter, but so that's meant to be this picture. This line here is free theories. This line is some interaction between the particles. And if you restrict yourself to free theories, it looks like there's a wall preventing you from getting from here to here. But if you turn on this coupling constant, you can go around that wall and connect them. So the first example of this was found by Fidkowski and Kataev, which is a one-dimensional chain where the symmetry is time reversal, and this k is actually the number of Majorana fermions at each site of the chain. And so it turns out that if there are 8 such things, you can they found a path in the space of Hamiltonians that goes from no Majorana fermions, which means totally trivial state, to the one where there are 8. Okay, and then so that's making interactions making fewer different states, but there are also states whose existence requires interactions. So, for example, any state that involves bosons, which if the bosons didn't interact, they would just bose condense, and it would be boring according to my criterion. I don't mean to say that superfluids are boring. A simplifying feature of the space of such things is that they form a group. And the group law is very simple. So here's a picture of SPT state A, and it has a boundary, which I've denoted by this little red arrow indicating that something interesting is some interesting degrees of freedom are living there, like you might want to think that it's some chiral edge mode. And the addition law of the group A plus B is you take A and you take B and you put them on top of each other, and you add all the terms to the Hamiltonian coupling A and B that are allowed by the symmetries. Okay, so the resulting state is A plus B. Okay, and so it's the claim that it's a group means that there has to be an inverse, and the inverse is just obtained by reversing the orientation. It's just the parity image of A. And a way to see that this has to be is, so clearly I could consider A on a cylindrical geometry where there's only one boundary, and then I can just mush that cylinder, right? So this the edge mode here and the edge mode there are both edge modes of A, but with opposite orientations. But then I can just make the cylinder smaller, right? So, and I can think about making that cylinder smaller as being achieved by some coupling between this mode and that mode. And so there must be some coupling between those modes which gets rid of them. Okay, and so that's the inverse of the group law. A few comments about this. If it's very important, the assumption that there's no topological order is very important, because if I had some anions living in the bulk, the fact that I've gotten rid of these edge modes doesn't matter at all to them. And so putting two of these states on top of each other just doubles the number of species of anions. It just multiplies, yeah. And so those states with topological order do not form a group. The second comment is that there can be many realizations of the non-trivialness of the edge of A, which you might refer to as the essential SPT-ness of the state. And so it may be that the form of A and the form of minus A look very different. So for example, this example with a free fermion topological insulators, with translation invariance, the edge is a single Dirac cone, which is the thing you see in the movies and the newspapers. But the symmetry protecting that is charge conservation and time reversal, and in particular, not translation invariance. And another realization of the same SPT-ness is obtained by some extremely disordered Chalker-Coddington network model, which has very different exponents than just a free Dirac fermion. But nevertheless, if you put one of them with one orientation on top of the other one with the opposite orientation, you can cancel them out. And you can get rid of the interestingness, whatever that is. And even more dramatically, the edge of A can preserve the symmetry, but have a gap. So when I said that the edge states are non-trivial, I don't necessarily mean that they're gapless. So many people have pointed out that they can be gapped, but have intrinsic topological order on the edge. And so the last time,
so it's not like they're absorbing some anomaly.
Well, I don't know. It's like they're absorbing some anomaly, but in a very unfamiliar way. So, for example, so I'll talk about some more explicit examples of this. But it could be some Z2 gauge theory on the edge. But the thing that's different about it from some Z2 gauge theory for which you could make an explicit lattice model, which preserves all the symmetry, is the way the symmetries are realized on the excitations. And so the last time I gave this version of this talk, Sabir gave me a hard time that he didn't know what the inverse of a Z2 of a spin liquid was. And this is a very interesting question, but the thing I mean by the inverse is not that you can gap them out because it's already gapped, but rather that it can cancel out the essential SPT-ness of it, whatever that is. And I think a more explicit characterization of what I mean by that would be useful. But Okay, that's an important point. Okay, so now that I've made a big deal about the fact that there's some group classifying these things, somebody's going to want to know what the group is, and I don't know. There's a very useful conjecture for what it is due to Wen and his collaborators, which is that it has to do with this Borel cohomology of the classifying space of G, which somebody can explain to me what that is. In some simple examples, it reduces to group cohomology. This conjecture is not complete. There are some states which are not, which provably exist, but which are not realized by this classification. Okay, Kataev knows what the answer is, and Kapustin has recently published something he claims is the right answer. But I don't want to talk about that more. The thing I want to talk about is an implication of this group structure, which can be pursued by examples. You don't need to know what all the possibilities are. So the implication is the following thing, which is suppose that you could make a lattice model of some edge theory of an SPT state, which explicitly preserves all the symmetries and is a completely local model with some local Hilbert space, everything you might want. Then you could just stick that thing on the surface of, you know, or rather stick the edge theory of minus A on the surface of A. You know, by this assumption, it carries all of the essential SPT-ness of A, and then you can couple them because it, you know, preserves all the symmetries, so you must be able to, you know, couple them preserving all the symmetries by the definition of minus A, and so in this way you could remove the essential SPT-ness of A without doing anything to the bulk, right? So if what I've told you is true, it must be that this is impossible, right? Because this, it would mean that the edge theory could not characterize the bulk. And the conclusion then is that the edge theories of these states can't be regularized intrinsically in their number of dimensions while exactly preserving the symmetries in a way that you could gauge. Okay, and so such things I'll call surface-only models because they can only live on the surface of something. And I guess another term for this, which as you might guess was coined by Senthil, is that they're not edgeable. Okay, and so many people have studied this implication. And let me say a little bit about points people have made from this point of view about regularizing the standard model. So the most famous example of an obstruction along these lines is the Nielsen-Inomuna fermion doubling theorem, which says that it's not possible to regulate free fermions on some lattice, or in fact in any way, while preserving the chiral symmetry, exactly preserving the chiral symmetry in a way that you could gauge, which we care about, because the weak interactions only act on the left moving fermions. The weak interactions are a chiral symmetry, the weak interaction gauge symmetry. And this result can be recast as a statement about SPT states by thinking about this theory of a free massive relativistic fermion in 4 plus 1 dimensions, not something that you might want to do for phenomenology. But the two possible signs of this real mass, it has to be real, label distinct phases of matter. One way to see that they're distinct phases of matter is by coupling this thing to an external gauge field and integrating out the fermions. You can measure that it has this topological response. The coefficient of this term is quantized, and the sign of it is the mass. It's given by the sign of the mass. And so you can't continuously vary this plus or minus from one to the other, from one sign to the other. A domain wall between these two states where the sign of the mass changes sign as a function of the extra dimension hosts a chiral fermion, an exponentially localized 3 plus 1 dimensional chiral fermion. And so this idea has been, people have tried to use this and have actually used it to put chiral gauge theories on the lattice. But there's an obstacle, which is that if you want a finite lattice, which you know some people do, then you need to have periodic boundary conditions or something like that, in which case there has to be another domain wall before you get back to here. And that other domain wall carries fermions of the opposite chirality, which are going to get in the way. So if you make the extra dimensions too big, the gauge fields are too, the Kaluza-Klein modes of the gauge fields are too light. And if you make it too close, then the two chiralities will interfere with each other. Okay, so there, it's important to note that there's a very important loophole in this theorem, which is that which we should think we should be able to take advantage of, because the standard model gauge group is not anomalous, right? There is no anomaly for the standard model gauge group, and so we shouldn't need extra dimensions, at least for this purpose. We may need them for other reasons, and that loophole, which many people have tried to exploit, is the fact that it assumes that the fermions are free, that the interaction, that the action for the fermions is Gaussian, and so an old idea is that you might be able to add four fermion interactions, or some couplings to other fields, which produce an energy gap for the fermions living on the other domain wall, the so-called mirror fermions, but which first of all preserve lead to a ground state which preserves the standard model gauge group, and which doesn't do anything to the fermions of which we are made. So you might imagine that you want the coupling constant for these for this four fermion term to be big on the other domain wall and small where we are, and these interactions should explicitly break all of the anomalous global symmetries, as you might expect, since if they weren't broken in a regularized model, they would be symmetries. And so the pursuit of this idea, which I really like, is one by Preskill and Eitan from 1986, where they built SU5 and SO10 lattice guts using this idea, and gave a very explicit prescription for what the four fermion terms you should try to add are. It was, an interesting fact is that it required them to add a right-handed neutrino to make these couplings, and they gave evidence that using lattice strong coupling, Euclidean strong coupling expansion, that this does produce a mass for the mirror fermions without breaking the thing you want to become the standard model gauge symmetry.
I was confused about this, when I send one of the walls to the
data. Well, remember, this is a dimension that we can't see, right?
Then I will have only one pair of models.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the, all other fermion models will be gapped. Mm-hmm. And then I don't need to put other fields in the box. I can put them on the boundary.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But the that's right. But the problem is that when you then want to also include the dynamics of the gauge fields.
Yeah, let them stay on the boundary for the
match. That's hard to do.
As I understand it, that's what people do. Actually, one of the ways just to explicitly integrate out to solve the equation for the fermions.
That's right. There are some problems for which, I mean, I'm not saying domain wall fermions are not useful, but the thing, it is not a regularization of the whole standard model.
It's not very good.
Yeah, so that's the problem that I'm describing.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. That's thank you for pointing that out. And so I guess I should mention that there's a lot of other work on this kind of idea that I'm not citing. And in particular, there have been some recent papers by Zhagong and Juven in this direction. I wanted to advertise a piece of work by Chen Kizhu and his people, which is I think can be regarded as new evidence that this scheme is more likely to work if the number of chiral fermions per generation is an integer multiple of 16, okay, which is a true statement, it's a true statement if there's a right-handed neutrino, and so that it matches very nicely with this construction of Preskill and Eitan. So let me describe the logic of this idea, and it's an important consequence of this collapse of the free fermion classification of SPT states that I mentioned. And so I mentioned that there was this collapse of this classification for one-dimensional chains, which preserve time reversal symmetry, where Fikowski and Kataev showed that the edge, the SPT-ness of the edge of eight Majorana chains could be removed, that its non-triviality could be gotten rid of in a way that preserves the symmetry. And the way they did this for the string theorists was using bosonization and refermionization. It's actually exactly the same one that we used to show the equivalence of various formulations of superstrings. So I was able to understand what they said because of that. And this is the initial step of a recursive procedure where you increase the number of dimensions, which works as follows. So first, suppose I want to think about some phase, which is I want to know whether. So I have some. Okay, let me start again. I have some candidate state of some fermions preserving some symmetry G, and I want to know whether using interactions I can adiabatically connect it to the trivial state. And so first consider a neighboring phase where the thing spontaneously breaks the symmetry. So that means that there's some expectation value of some order parameter that transforms on trivial under the symmetry. And then to get back to the symmetry preserving state, to the paramagnetic state, I proliferate defects of that order parameter, right? So I condense the vortex lines or whatever they are to reach the paramagnetic phase. And then I ask if in doing so, those defects must carry some quantum numbers, which would then make the paramagnet non-trivial. So for example, if there are some fermion zero modes in the core of the vortex, then condensing the vortex necessarily does something interesting, right? It's not just a trivial paramagnet. And if that's the case, then it can't be true that paramagnet can be adiabatically connected to the trivial state. So this is defects in the core of the order of the, sorry, interesting things in the cores of the order parameter are obstructions to having to adiabatically connecting the state to a trivial state. And the sense in which this is a recursion is the following. So consider, for example, the case where we're thinking about a Z2 symmetry. No, sorry. Let's do this one first. Suppose we're thinking about a U1 symmetry in three dimensions. So then when we break it, the order parameter is some complex field, and the defects are vortex lines that we've been hearing a lot about. So then you can think about what is the field theory living on this vortex line, and ask whether there's some zero modes there. Or for example, if we were thinking about some SO3 symmetry, the defects would be some kind of hedgehog, and you can ask whether there's something inside, something living there. And there are many examples where the thing living there is very closely related to the thing living at the ends of these one-dimensional chains. And so for example, let me try to give an explicit example. So there's a case where the group is SO3 times Z2 times time reversal, where in the defect of the SO3 order, there's a Meyer on a zero mode which realizes time reversal in exactly this way. So then you know if you had 8 copies of that state, there would be 8 Meyer on a zero modes living there. And then using exactly this prescription, you could make them eat each other. And so in that way, you can adiabatically connect the 8 copies of this state to the trivial one, or rather, this obstruction to doing that does not exist. Okay, and so in this way, people have built up a series of collapses of this classification of free fermion things. And in this paper, they asked what happens if you go to 4+1 dimensions. So what are 4?
So it's obvious that changing the number of fermions doesn't change anything about the phase structure.
Well, no, it does. So adding more fermions, so we can just tensor them together and ask what happens. And so if they're just tensored together, then the number of zero modes is linear in the number of fermions. Mm-hmm. And so when the number of fermions is 8 times the case where you get 1 zero mode, then you get exactly this case. And so they can eat each other. Right? So the number of fermions matters. And so the thing these people showed is that for many choices of group, the collapse in 4+1 dimensions again happens when this number is a multiple of 8, which is the case when on a domain wall, like the one I described earlier, the thing you would want the chiral fermions to live on, it would mean that there are 16 chiral fermions living on the wall, which conveniently is the number of chiral fermions we have in each generation. So this is some evidence that this strategy for identify obstructions to gapping the mirror fermions doesn't have an obstruction, right? So it's the absence of an obstruction that could have been there in the case that we think is true. An awkward fact is that all the cases where this happens, the group involves time reversal, which as far as I know is not a part of the standard model gauge group. But okay, so take it for what it's worth. So I'm going to describe by example another different class of obstructions in 3+1 dimensions.
Previously, you said Eric Poppins was going to have problems, but he didn't try.
Good. He didn't try to do the four-dimensional case. He tried to do this thing called the 3-2-1 model, which actually Juven and Zhagong wrote a paper about recently. So it's a 1+1-dimensional field theory where the charge, there's a bunch of species of fermions where the charges are chosen so that 3² + 4² is equal to 5². So that's the axial anomaly in 1+1 dimensions. And so you might think that you could symmetrically gap them out by adding well-chosen four fermion interactions. There's apparently some disagreement about which four fermion interactions you should add. But they made some choice for which ones to add, and they found evidence that there were still Gapple's modes. But I think it's not conclusive.
Can I make a comment?
Go ahead.
So I just say that the work they did, I think they ate all the things to allow Higgs terms, also recover Higgs terms mediated by fermions between the four fermions. But in the sense that the recent study we have about whether the eighth can be gapped or not, I think maybe one of the famous works is Michael Lavin. And we also have a similar work. So I understand whether the eighth can be gapped is ready to whether those the statistics of those particles can form certain the grading statistics can be triggered from those
Can I summarize? I think the short answer is that they think that if you add fewer interactions, it'll work.
Okay.
And they have a prescription for understanding which interactions you should add.
I see.
There's a particular way to design the interaction to make it work, but I think they just add all kinds of interactions.
Okay. So they didn't add the right kind
yeah.
of interaction.
That's,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I think it's the right idea. Okay, so here's a strategy for identifying such obstructions. So consider some simple because we want to be able to solve it, gapped some topological field theory in 4+1 dimensions, because we want to make obstructions in 3+1 dimensions, that doesn't have topological order, so that we can use these ideas, and that preserves some symmetry G in some nice way. And then put the model on a space with boundary, with symmetry-preserving boundary conditions, and then whatever you get, if you can figure out what it is a surface-only theory with respect to that symmetry, right? By the argument I've outlined. That is, it can't be regulated by a local 3+1-dimensional model while manifestly preserving the symmetry. And the thing I'm going to do is the analog of what's called the K-matrix approach to 2+1-dimensional SPTs, which means studying them using Chern-Simons theory. So before I do this, let me make a few more comments about what it means for something to be a surface-only state. They're perfectly consistent things that exist. They can be unitary, and we know that because they can be realized as the edge of some gapped bulk theory. It's just that they can't be regularized in a way that preserves all the symmetries without the bulk. And so it means that they won't be found as low energy limits of solids or other ways you might imagine study them, but of course this is not conclusive because symmetries can be emergent, or I guess if this is a high energy meaning, I should say accidental. And it also doesn't rule out more crazy realizations involving decoupling limits of gravity. Okay. So some known examples of obstructions that were derived by this kind of logic, these three examples are all in 2+1 dimensions. And the symmetry involves time reversal. So one of them is a nonlinear sigma model in the two-sphere with a certain hop term, which was proposed as a very early model of high TC. Another was a candidate gapless spin liquid, where the vortices are fermions. And another one, which is similar to an example I'm going to talk about, is an all fermion toric code, which is a Z2 gauge theory, where both the electric excitation, the magnetic excitation, and also their bound state, also the sort of dion object, are all fermions. So that's not what you get from any lattice gauge theory that manifestly preserves time reversal. So these are all in 2+1 dimensions, and an example which has been proved to be not edgeable by these guys, including Drew Potter, is a version of Maxwell theory, just U1 gauge theory, where, just like in this example, the electric charge, the magnetic charge, and the dion are all fermions. And in this case, there's the dramatic fact that not only is it in triples in dimension, but the symmetry group is nothing. One doesn't require any, you know, it's the statement is just that you can't put this theory on a lattice. I'm going to say more about this example. So here's the simple 4 plus 1 dimensional theory that we're going to think about. It's ridiculously simple. It's just like Chern-Simons theory in 2 plus 1 dimensions, except it's in 4 plus 1 dimensions. And so in order for, so I'm using the language of forms. I hope that's not regarded as too fancy. So these things are two-form potentials. That means, you know, things with two antisymmetric indices. And the action is just like in Chern-Simons theory, it's like A wedge F. It's the potential wedge, the field string. And a dramatic difference from 2 plus 1 dimensions is that because these things have two indices, the two forms commute with each other, but a two-form and a three-form anti-commute. What I'm trying to say is that this thing is anti-symmetric, unlike in two dimensions where it's symmetric, in 2 plus 1 dimensions where it's symmetric. And so that means you need more than one of them, because if you have only one of them, this is a total derivative, okay? Because this thing is not zero, unlike A wedge A. And it's a topological field theory because I didn't have to introduce a metric to write this down. And this kind of model has been studied for many different reasons by many different people. The way I'd like you to think about it is just like a gauge field couples minimally to the world line of a particle, this kind of two-form field couples minimally to the world sheet of a string, right? So just like we heard that we should couple two forms to vortex strings earlier, that's how I want you to think about these B fields. And a useful way to think about this object is if I add to this thing terms where this B couples minimally to the world sheets of two different kinds of strings, one coupling to each of two kinds of B fields, then this thing, this solving the equations of motion and plugging it back in here, computes the linking number of these world sheets. So two-dimensional space regions of space in five dimensions, if I have two of them, they can be linked, just like curves in three dimensions can be linked. Okay, but in this case, the linking number is anti-symmetric. Okay, and the simplest example of this, where there's just one of each kind, is realized importantly in type 2B string theory on ideas 5 times S5. The coefficient in front of here is n, which is the number of colors of the dual gauge theory. And a crucial hint for what I'm going to say is that type 2B S-duality, the strong weak coupling duality of that string theory, acts by interchanging these two forms. Okay, so that's going to be play an important role. And so the strategy for using this to identify obstructions to regulating quantum field theory is, so first of all, just solve the thing and ask when does it have topological order. So a simple criterion for which is counting the number of ground states on a topologically non-trivial space. A necessary condition for not having topological order is that there's a unique ground state. And then after you do that, in the case where there's no topological order, just identify the edge states and the symmetry. Okay, so the answer to these questions, very briefly, is that there's no topological order if the Pfaffian of this K-matrix is 1. So that's like the determinant of the K-matrix in 2 plus 1 dimensions. And the edge states, in the simplest realization, is just ordinary Maxwell theory, just abelian gauge theory, where roughly the way you should think about it arising is that B is dA. Right? So the two-form becomes the field strength of the gauge field. But it's a version of Maxwell theory where electromagnetic duality is manifest. So the symmetry that interchanges B and C becomes becomes electromagnetic duality in the gauge theory on the boundary.
So there's no even local action.
That's manifestly symmetric. That's right. Exactly. And so, in particular, even if you break Lorentz symmetry, it's not possible to regularize this theory, which in a way that manifestly preserves this, which is relevant because these smart gentlemen constructed a continuum, but not Lorentz invariant theory, which did this. So I'm claiming that theory cannot be regulated. And a corollary of this is that it's not possible to gauge electromagnetic duality. But so far, I've been speaking about a theory where I haven't added any matter to that U1 gauge theory. So I've just been talking about a free theory, right? We know that, I think we know everything about that theory that we might want to know and don't really need to put it on the lattice. So it's more interesting to ask, what happens if I add matter to this theory? And the way to do that is using the fact that the ends of the strings, so here's a picture of, this is the fifth dimension, and here's, you are here, the three plus one dimensional theory. The ends of these strings are electric and magnetic charges, so the ends of the strings coupling to B are electric charges, and the ends of the strings coupling to C are magnetic charges. And an important consequence of this manifest duality symmetry of this theory is that the electric charges, the magnetic charge, and the dion all have to have the same statistics, because the duality symmetry, which acts in this way on the charge lattice, and I guess I should mention that the T operation is realized by adding to the action. The T operation is just this. And so that's also a symmetry. And that shifts the theta angle of the boundary gauge theory by 2 pi, as you might expect. And so this, you know, you can map the boson to the monopole by this thing that's supposed to be a symmetry, and so they must have the same statistics. Okay, and so you can ask, well, what if they're all bosons? Right, so that's one possibility. But actually, that's not a possibility, because if both the electron and the monopole are bosons, then a very famous fact is that the dion, then the bound state of the electron and the monopole, is a fermion. And you know, this is sometimes called spin from isospin, but there's a very simple way to see this, which is, if you, so here's a picture of a dion that's in a monopole and that's an electron bound to it, and this is the magnetic flux coming out of it, and here's a picture of another one. And so if I take this one and rotate it around that one by pi, then that results in the same state of the theory up to a translation. And so it relates the Berry phase that the wave function picks up by doing that appears there in this relationship between the coefficients of the wave function of the same state, and that Berry phase, using the direct monopole field with the minimal charge, is equal to pi, and so that thing is, these things are fermions. Okay, and so you can't, they can't all be bosons, but they can all be fermions. Okay, and so this was exactly this all fermion electrodynamics that I mentioned. And so this is a description of the 4 plus 1 dimensional SPT theory, whose edge produces this all fermion electrodynamics. This is evidence for its existence, but I guess it's useful to have a more explicit description of how that arises. And so such a thing is, well, Brian and I have been working on it this week, and it seems to be possible to make a pretty explicit construction of this using what's called a coupled layer construction, where we imagine building the bulk by taking layers of some version of the edge theory and coupling and sort of stitching them together. And so the way this works is actually very similar to a construction that worked to build the bulk theory of this all fermion toric code in 2 plus 1 dimensions. And the idea could be called dion string condensation. And so the idea is the following. So each layer in this picture, so this is a picture of the fifth dimension. Maybe it's the fourth dimension. No, okay, which I always get confused about. The extra one. And so we have six layers, each of which is just ordinary bosonic electrodynamics. So U1 lattice gauge theory coupled to bosonic charges. That's something that exists, no question. And we imagine we're going to make it so that the dion in this layer and the monopole in this layer and the anti-dion in this layer are coupled together in such a way that the whole combination condenses. And when that happens, it breaks, it variously Higgses and confines the gauge theories, the relative gauge groups in these layers, and glues them together. Okay. So maybe I won't say too much more about that, but it's... Yeah, so good. That's an important thing. So here's the crucial thing. So here's a little bit more detail. I won't say too much about it, but the crucial thing is that this monopole and this dion are certainly not mutually local with each other, but under this gauge group. But this combination of the monopole in this layer and the dion in this layer is mutually local with this combination in the other layer. And so it's
That's right.
And so that means that condensing this object confines all of the other excitations. And so it glues the monopoles into strings, which are these strings. And it attaches the electric flux of the other group to the monopole strings. And so that's exactly the effect of this term. So that's the way that theory comes out. Okay. So the punchline is don't try to put this theory on the lattice, because you won't be able to do it. okay. How much time do I have? 5 minutes, okay. So in the last 5 minutes, I want to tell you a little bit about a much more explicit construction. It has its aesthetic value of simpler examples of SPT states in two Poisson dimensions with discrete symmetry groups. As you can probably tell from the results I've told you about, a lot of effort has been put into thinking about classifying these states, and there are many fewer explicit constructions. And an explicit construction of these states is important if you want to, for example, figure out where they're realized in nature, or more interesting to me, maybe understand phase transitions between them, and the topological states that you get by gauging the symmetry. We wanted to understand the case of Zn paramagnets in two Poisson dimensions. So the case of Z2 has been beautifully solved by Levin and Gu. So they found another Ising model in two Poisson dimensions, which if you preserve the Z2 symmetry, you cannot adiabatically connect it to the ordinary transverse field Ising model. And the method they used was basically using something like lattice duality, where they knew already the model that you would get if you gauged the symmetry, and then they basically erased all the gauge fields. That method was not available for Zn until sometime earlier this year when Michael Levin constructed these more general things. The construction that we made has some virtues, one of which is that translation invariance is not required. So this model works for, you just pick an arbitrary graph that you like, with one small restriction. The thing I was happiest about in this construction is that we can make a very uniform construction of the things that become the string operators when you gauge the symmetry, the things that you use to construct the not the quasiparticles with interesting statistics. So the construction, I think, illuminates connections between the existing constructions. So here's the starting point. You can, as many people know, a symmetry that's anomalous can be realized in a lattice model if you realize it in a way that acts on more than one side of the lattice at a time. And so this fact is not, I guess it's not very widely appreciated. I didn't know it until recently, but this is the way chiral symmetry is realized in the staggered fermion construction in lattice gauge theory. And the reason that this is okay with the fact that you can't gauge the symmetry is that, well, if it's realized in this way, you can't gauge the symmetry, because you can't just stick link variables between the sides and make the thing gauge invariant. So for example, in this Levin-Gu construction, the symmetry at the edge acts by flipping the spins, this is sigma x, and also acting by this phase that depends on the state of the nearby sites. So this is, you can think of this as, it flips the spins but then multiplies by a phase which counts the number of domain walls between the spins. Okay, and so, well, how do I know that with the given realization of the symmetry, I can't just do some change of variables or a basis rotation on my Hilbert space and make it into an ordinary one? And I don't know, but in this case, I'll tell you how to find a criterion for that. This is one place where group cohomology comes into the discussion. And I'm going to focus on the case where I make a lattice model where each site there's a Zn spin. So this is the generalization of the Pauli algebra, where this is an nth root of unity, and so there's n states, and omega Zn is diagonal, and I'm going to use some projectors onto these states, and x is a shift, clock. Which one is shift? One of them is clock, and one of them is shift. If you change bases, they switch roles. The idea of our construction is, you tell me some action of the symmetry on the edge that you like, that you might think is non-trivial. So here's a picture of the edge, and this arrow denotes some orientation and some prescription for defining the symmetry, and this P is going to be a label on the SPT state. and we couple together bags of that stuff. Okay, so you should think of each of these pink things as some little island of the state that we're trying to build, and think of it as the whole thing as a site, because the symmetry acts non-locally within the site. And so you should sort of squint at that and think of that as a single site. And then we couple these things together in a way that stitches together a 2 plus 1 dimensional theory. And so for the case of Z2, a model along these lines was made by these people. So the blue is going to describe the interactions between these things, and the pink is describing these little islands. So the blue is the couplings between the islands, and the pink is the islands.
Okay, and pink is literally...
Yeah, you should think of, you know, this is zooming in on the boundary of one of those pink regions. And so the pink stuff is the stuff we're trying to build. And imagine starting with little chunks of it and gluing them together. That's the idea.
So the boundary theory prescribes for you how the things couple in there.
Right, that's right. That's right. So P is a label. So P is going to be, it's going to go from 0 to n, 1 to n, and it's going to distinguish different states. Okay. All right. And the Hamiltonian is this.
Ground.
Yes?
In ground states, these blue regions would describe maximum entangled.
That's right. That's right. So there's going to be multipartite entanglement in this construction, where the sites on the four, on the, well, sorry, the number doesn't have to be 4, but in the picture it's 4 corners of the square are entangled with each other. That's right.
Why did you choose squares?
Because they were easier to draw. I tried to make Mathematica draw random bag graphs, but I actually failed. I had to get back to work. Well, okay, you'll see the triangles is a small problem. Okay, so the Hamiltonian that we're going to study is this thing which basically just glues together these sites. So it puts it in this state. So it's this kind of GHZ state for each of the blue squares, and the ground state of the Hamiltonian is just a product of those things. Okay, so B is this thing. It flips each of these spins at the same time, and it acts with projectors on these red links to set the states of those sites equal. The way you should think about it is just like smushing this down. It's gluing, setting all of those things equal in a symmetric way. And okay, you'll notice that this Hamiltonian didn't say anything about what the symmetry was. And the choice of symmetry, and so the information about that is in the way the symmetry acts. So the symmetry generator of the system is you flip the spins, and then you act with these phases, which act within the bags. So it's exactly the thing that you told me in the input, and this commutes with that Hamiltonian. And the reason... The sort of nice thing about this construction is that if you cut the thing open, so if we make a boundary of this thing, don't cut open the bags, but stop the thing, then at the edge of this picture, there's exactly this realization of the symmetry you wanted, acting on these sort of combined sites of these edges of the bag. Okay, so that's the point of this construction, and the claim that we're making about it is that perturbing this Hamiltonian, which is of course very ridiculously simple, by terms that respect this symmetry, which if you add them, I'm not going to be able to solve it anymore. But by doing that, I claim that you, no matter what you do, you can't remove the interestingness of the edge. So either the edge has to be gapless, or it has to break the symmetry. It has to realize the symmetry in an interesting way. A shortcoming of the construction that we have is that we can only do it for a bipartite graph. I don't understand the reason for this obstruction. Somebody can tell me if they know. So the crucial ingredient in this construction is the phase on the links of the bags. And the thing you need is a unitary operator that depends on two of these Zn rotors, which satisfies the group law, which means the nth power of the thing had better be 1, written in an interesting way. And the interesting way that you have to write 1 is that it has to be the product of the spins on neighboring sites. And because the edge of an edge is nothing, because the boundary of a boundary is nothing, this chain of products has to close. And so there's a cancellation between each one and the next one, which goes on forever, and they eat each other, and you get 1. The second condition is that you have to be able to pair these things up, that the thing with label minus p has to be the inverse of the thing with label p, so that if you couple these two things, you get nothing. You get no edge anymore. And then finally, there's this non-triviality condition. And the condition that we're going to impose is this kind of equation, which don't look at it too closely, but is going to be the condition that, the braiding of fluxes is non-trivial, which I'm going to explain what that means. Okay, so what I mean by that is the following thing. So this system enjoys the following domain wall operators. So these are operators which in the shaded region act like the symmetry, and so they commute with the part of the Hamiltonian that's in that region, and over here they do nothing. And at the edge, you design it so that the whole thing commutes with the Hamiltonian. And this simple formula, where this C is just the phase that appears in the Hamiltonian, or appears in the symmetry, and this X is the same thing, and these are the projectors that appear in the Hamiltonian, accomplishes this. It commutes with the Hamiltonian. And the way you can think about it, it's like doing a gauge transformation by the symmetry. So we do the symmetry locally in this region. If we gauge the symmetry, it would really do nothing. And so these are things that become the string operators in the gauged theory. Yes? Look at the picture. Yeah. I wish I could draw the pictures in 3+1 dimensions. Yeah. Okay. And so the thing I'm very happy about is the C that appears here is the same C that was in the definition of the symmetry. We didn't have to do any fancy business about left turns and right turns. And the solution of those the condition above is the simple equation in terms of those projectors, a version of which appears in a paper that Juven and Luis Santos wrote for these special.
The recent version had formulas for all the n's, not only
n plus 3. Well, oh, okay. In your recent version. Recent version.
I'm just saying we have formulas for all the n's, capital n's, not only n equals 2.
I see. Okay. All right. Well, there it is. Okay. All right. So the point about these domain wall operators is the following: if we act with these domain wall operators in closed regions, then they commute with each other. And so the fact that they commute with the Hamiltonian also doesn't really tell you that much. But if the domain walls intersect once, which they can do if there's a boundary of the space, so you see here they intersect just once, then they satisfy this Heisenberg algebra. And that algebra has to be represented on the spectrum because they each commute with the Hamiltonian. And so this implies this degeneracy of the spectrum in the presence of a boundary. One way of which you can satisfy it is if there's a gapless mode. Okay. And this is the answer for the statistics of the anions that you get if you gauge the symmetry. Okay.
They're always abelian.
In this construction, it's abelian. That's right. Yeah, so if there are... I know how to do the abelian anions. Yes, that's right. Okay, so this gives a very practical condition for determining whether your edge symmetry is non-trivial. Okay, so I promised Rob I would make a movie. I would show a movie, and the movie I want to show is a picture of a coarse graining transformation, which turns this construction into one that's more like the Levin-Gu construction, where we've basically been identifying the spins around the corners of this plaquette. We've just been setting them equal at low energies, and so on the low energy Hilbert space, you can just identify them and make a simpler lattice. Which, where did it go? Oh, where's my cursor?
It's on the screen.
No. Ah, there we go. Okay. I knew where it was. Sorry. So here's a movie of a coarse graining transformation where you just shrink down the sites that you're identifying together and glue together these bags. Okay, sorry, it's a very repetitive movie. Okay. Have you? Where? maybe it's in the new version of Juven's paper. okay. It's a coarse graining transformation of the slides. Okay. All right. So I guess I should wrap up. A nice fact is that you can make a simple Hamiltonian for this symmetric theory of the edge, and it looks like that. which for Z2 is solvable by a Jordan-Wigner transformation, and you can explicitly see that only the left mover carries the symmetry, and so that's what's anomalous about it. It only acts on the left mover. Okay, so I think I should stop. Let me just conclude with some questions. One of which is I'd like to understand what the origin of this restriction to bipartite graphs is, because I claimed that P minus P is just obtained by reversing the orientation, but I wasn't able to realize that in the lattice model. Okay, and then finally, it would be very nice to find a more explicit relationship between the kinds of instructions I've described and and anomaly inflow. So I would like someone, I'd like to understand exactly what it is that's anomalous about this all fermion electrodynamics. Okay, so yeah, clearly high energy theorists and condensed matter theorists should keep talking to each other. Thanks.
You want to use these models in there for your somehow state phase transition?
I would like to. Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, yes. That's right. Yeah. I haven't done it yet. I haven't done it yet at all. Yeah.
This would involve Mary.
I think so. I don't know. I mean, maybe you could consider just Well, okay. I don't know. Yeah, that's future. Yeah. Yes, please.
I have a comment, but you made a statement that you can't have the electric charge. You made a statement that the electric charge and the electric charge and the dion can't cause the photons.
Yeah.
When you have SL3 there. Is there a comment about that? That you have a smaller group? If you take a level 2, there's a level 2 subgroup to the larger group.
Uh-huh.
It does allow the multi photons.
Oh.
So you have a smaller symmetry if it's possible.
But I'm confused. The reason I think they can't all be bosons is because of this effect that the electromagnetic field in the presence of a dion carries an extra unit of spin,
yeah,
half
if
unit.
Yeah, if it's tricky, so you can only ever add M2.
Ah.
Oh,
I see.
I see.
So it's like there's only charge 2 monopoles or something like that. I see. Yeah, that's interesting. I see.
Right.
I don't know how to modify this weird two-form theory to break the symmetry to that. Yeah, that would be interesting. Yeah.
I guess you'd play the same game in three dimensions.
In three dimensions. 3+1 dimensions.
Yeah.
You mean like with BF theory?
Well, the bags.
Yes. This is very interesting. Yeah, I would very much like to pursue that. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So gluing things together in this way, I think, is very interesting. Yes.
Can you summarize the differences between this and Chen and Shadow's
Which of their things are you referring to?
It looks very similar to the pictures.
Oh, in their CZX paper. Yeah. So they I should say more clearly. They made a construction along these lines for Z2, which is very nice. I had to force Brian to help me do this, because he was like, this is boring, we understand all this. But I really very badly wanted to understand what was special about Z2. This Levin-Gu construction is absolutely beautiful, right? They have this explicit unitary matrix that breaks the symmetry but goes from the transverse field Asian model to their construction, right? It's this, this thing with a 24 in it, in the exponent. It came, out of the forehead of God, right? From my point of view, and I wanted to be able to understand it. And so that coarse graining transformation that I was showing is sort of an attempt to build. Yeah. Okay.